All right, so we are currently in 1 Samuel. We discussed last time the new timeline, looking at the ages of these six people. We looked at a revised, sort of more in-detail timeline of 1 Samuel chapters 8 through 12. And we looked at the very confusing passage of Acts chapter 13 and verse 1 and compared it, 1 Samuel 13, 1 and compared it to Acts 13, 21 to see the length of Saul's reign. And I mentioned last time that we would start off with the Psalms because this is about where, once we finish looking at Acts chapter 13 and verse 1, and we look at Saul's campaigns in 1 Samuel 13 through 15, we see that there's this gap of time in chapter 14 towards the end. It just talks about a lot of the campaigns that Saul had gone through, so That period of time is about 25 to 30 years. And then we get to, well, at least in that part of chapter 14. And then we get to chapter 15. Chapter 15, it brings about the reason why David was called. And do you remember what happened in chapter 15? There was a battle with the Amalekites, right? And this battle with the Amalekites... Oh, good. This battle with the Amalekites was something that Samuel, as a directive from God, told Saul to do, right? But he didn't complete it. He didn't do the... everything that Samuel told Saul to do. So he didn't obey God as a result. And so God wanted a king that would follow after him. And so he had gone to Bethlehem in chapter 16 in search for David. And so in 1 Samuel 16, we encountered David. Now, how many brothers did David have?
Two?
He had a lot more than that. He had seven brothers. That's right. He had seven brothers. Now, you see this in 1 Samuel, but in 1 Chronicles... he appears to only have six. How do you reconcile that? That's in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, I believe. Looking at the timeline of, or the family of David. Who is this missing brother? Is this a contradiction? What's going on? Well, 1 Chronicles was written long after the events that are recorded at that point. So it should be obvious. I mean, they should have listed everybody, at least from our thinking. One possible explanation is that one of David's brothers had died and without leaving anyone to... any children, without any children. And so as a result, he is omitted from the genealogy, the family of David in 1 Chronicles. But he's mentioned in 1 Samuel because perhaps at that time he was still living. Or perhaps at that time it was important because that's talking about things chronologically. The fact that David was the eighth son of Jesse, that he had seven older brothers who were all denied at least in terms of who would be the next king, that this, usually the youngest, had very little standing. And so, in this case, he was the youngest, he was the smallest, you know, the baby of the family, you know, just, oh, that's just David. So, people didn't really bat an eye toward David. Especially we see that in chapter 17. When his older brothers are in battle, or at least are in a standoff with the Philistines, and his older brothers are like, oh, what are you doing here? Go back to the sheep. You know, take care of them. Well, in this particular instance, we see David, and in my timeline, I have him writing one of the Psalms here in chapter 16, or at least around the events of chapter 16. Here's where I'm going to start talking more about the Psalms. And the Psalms are an interesting book. There are 150 of them. And, of course, the first one we already talked about, that Moses wrote all the way back, long time ago, in the wilderness wanderings. And that's Psalm 90. So we're going to look right now at a breakdown of the Psalms. We have 150 of them. Moses has written one of them. We see David has written 75, at least that we are relatively sure of. Solomon has written 2. The sons of Korah, 10. Asaph, 12. Heman and Ethan, 1 apiece. And there are 48 that are not attributed. Now, we know this, at least we're reasonably sure of this, because we have the inscriptions in each of the Psalms, at least all but 48 of them. Well, 50 of them. There's two of them that are not attributed that the New Testament attributes to David. And so, of course, we go by that. So they have these inscriptions. Now, some of them have inscriptions but are not attributed to anybody. And there are several around Psalm 120 through 130-something, the Songs of Ascents. There are several of those that we'll talk about more in a little bit, perhaps when we get there in the timeline. So there are these particular psalms. So I had found someone's guess as to where the 75 psalms that David had written was in David's timeline. Now the rest, except for Solomon and Moses, we don't know a whole lot about. We don't know much about the sons of Korah. We don't know much about Asaph, Heman, or Ethan. We know that they take place in the time of David. And so I will place them in the timeline sometime in the time of David. And in Psalm and the 75 psalms that David had written are going to be somewhere within David's timeline. And hopefully it'll work out in the end. I've been working all this week about that, especially when looking at David's reign. And I corrected a few things in Saul's reign, which is why I mention this now, because you already have the timeline, and I want to try to make sure that those things are corrected. In the timeline that I had seen for, or the chronology for David's psalms, several of them were repeated, and I think that's because they could potentially have been written during this one instance, or this other instance, or this other instance. And so, we really don't know. There may be half a dozen, maybe a few more psalms that are given an inscription that say, this takes place at this time. Psalm 3 says, this takes place after Absalom had rebelled against David's reign. David's reign. And so that's Psalm 3. Psalm 7 is something similar. And there are a few other psalms. Psalm 51 is the time when David had committed adultery with Bathsheba and had killed Uriah, her husband. And so that was written at around that time. And so we have some ideas for some of these psalms based on the inscriptions. One thing to note, the inscriptions are not inspired. They were written after the fact, and We're just not sure. But it is based off of the tradition, the Jewish tradition. And so I'm going to treat them as truth. Because what else can you do when it comes to when you're trying to time these things? So that's what I have for that. For the authors of the Psalms, here are the Psalms that are attributed. Okay. Two of the Psalms, Psalm 2 and Psalm 95, are attributed to David in the New Testament. Some of these Psalms are not attributed, but are generally believed to have been written by David. For instance, Psalm 10 is believed, at least in the Septuagint, to be a continuation of Psalm 9. And so if you look at the Septuagint and the numbers of the Psalms, they are different than ours. And at some point, it changes things. They actually have 151 Psalms in the Septuagint. They have one added. But they combine Psalm 9 and 10. They combine Psalm, I believe, 42 and 43. And they split up a couple Psalms later on so that it comes out evenly. And then you have the 151st, according to their idea. Now, 151st is alleged to have been written at around the time when David slew Goliath. But I don't have that in here because it's not in our Bibles, because it shouldn't be. It doesn't have the mark of inspiration. Psalm 89, Ethan's psalm, Ethan the Ezrahite. These are all Levites of some form of another. Sons of Korah, Asaph, Heman, and Ethan are all Levites. They're all Heman and Asaph and Ethan, I think, are among those who are the songwriters. And we see this particularly in 1 Chronicles 15 and 16, and we see it also a little bit later on. And the sons of Korah, many of them are gatekeepers, and so I have some of those on there as well. The one by Ethan the Ezrahite, is interesting. When you read that one, it sounds like it should be taken place much later. It talks about the end of David's line. Didn't you promise this to David? Didn't you promise all these wonderful things to David? And now look what's happened. And so some people surmise that this was written in the time of the exile, or perhaps around that time. Well, why think that? If Ethan the Ezrahite did write this, and he's clearly in the timeline of David, perhaps he was talking about the instance where David was kicked out of, as he was king, he was kicked out of his palace. When Absalom had his rebellion in the time of King David. So there's that later on in 2 Samuel 15, I believe, is when that occurs. 15, 16, and it goes on through a few more chapters. So there is that as well. And so one of the things I want to point out it's not that important. I don't think I will. I was going to point out some of the corrections I made, but it's really just on when the Psalms were written, and it's not that big of a deal, honestly. So I'm going to leave that where it is. All right. One thing I will mention in this particular timeline, we have... In Saul's campaigns, I have along here with 1 Samuel 14, that 47 through 52, right around here on that first page. I also have something that happens in 1 Chronicles 5. 1 Chronicles 5. And I place that here because I've got to place it somewhere. I feel like I have to place that somewhere. I guess I don't have to. But given trying to be consistent with everything that we're talking about, I want to try to place this somewhere. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, we see that Saul defeats a particular group of people. Rather, not Saul, but in the time of Saul, it says. And so we have that instance here in verse 10, and then 18 through 24. So if you will, let's read that for right now. 1 Chronicles chapter 5. And somebody read verse 10.
Now in the days of Saul, they made war with the Hagarites, who fell by their hand, and they dwelt in their tents throughout the entire area east of Gilead.
Alright, so, in the days of Saul, they made war with the Hagarites. So the question then is, who are the Hagarites? They're not really mentioned anywhere outside of 1 Chronicles, at least I haven't seen their mention anywhere. According to one of the commentators I looked at, the Hagarites, if you notice, look similar to Hagar. And so this is another name for the Ishmaelites, the descendants of Hagar, Ishmael's mother. So there was a conflict in the days of Saul with the Hagarites. And so I place that, again, in 1 Samuel 14, with all the many years that take place in between what happened earlier in 14 and chapter 15. So all the different things that occur there. And then verses 18 through, 24. I'll go ahead and read that. The sons of Reuben, the Gadites, the half-tribe, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 valiant men, able to bear shield and sword, to shoot with the bow, and skillful in war, who went to war. They made war with the Hagarites. So this is an explanation of what happened in verse 10. These tribes east of the Jordan have made war with the Hagarites, Jeter, Naphish, and Nodab. And they were helped against them, and the Hagarites were delivered into their hand, and all who were with them, for they cried out to God in the battle. He heeded their prayer because they put their trust in him. Then they took away their livestock, 50,000 of their camels, 250,000 of their sheep, and 2,000 of their donkeys, also 100,000 of their men. For many fell dead because the war was God's, and they dwelt in their place until the captivity. So the children of the half-tribe of Manasseh dwelt in the land. Their numbers increased from Bashan to Baal Hermon, that is, to Senir or Mount Hermon. These were the heads of their fathers' houses: Epher, Ishi, Eliel, Azrael, Jeremiah, Hodaviah, and Jadiel. They were mighty men of valor, famous men, and heads of their fathers' houses. So I mention that because you see these famous men come up, and these things occur during the reign of Saul. And you see that God is not just working with Saul and his army, he's also working with these tribes east of the Jordan. All right. Being on the east coast of America and always having lived on the east coast, I always think of the ocean as east. And so I have trouble in my mind distinguishing east and west when looking at the Holy Land, because the ocean, or at least the big body of water next to them, is on the west. So that's why I always have to think, oh, east, west, east, west. So that's my explanation anyway. That's my story anyway, and I'm sticking to it. All right, looking at this, there are a few confusing things that occur in chapters 16 and 17. David is called at the end of chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. He is called a man of war. This is before, and you can tell looking at chapter 17, you can tell that this was written, or this event, this talking about him as a man of war, was before David and Goliath. So how on earth does this advisor, unnamed advisor of Saul, consider him, David, a man of war? Let's look. He's mentioned in 1 Samuel 16. Let's start in verse 14. But the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. And Saul's servant said to him, "Surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Let our master now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp, and it shall be that he will play it with his hand when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, and you shall be well." So Saul said to his servants, "Provide me now a man who can play well, and bring him to me." And verse 18, "Then one of the servants answered and said, 'Look, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a handsome person, and the Lord is with him.'" So he goes and he calls David to come to him, and he becomes his musician, he becomes his armor bearer. And so first off, he's called a man of war. How does that servant know that? I mean, it's possible that this servant knows of David, but this is before David does any kind of battle. In fact, later in chapter 17, we see that his older brothers are putting him down. You know, you have no idea what you're talking about. You need to leave. And so he's called a man of war. Maybe this particular servant is just blowing smoke. Maybe he's just saying, "Oh, yes, I know this great musician," and he may have heard him play. And he's like, "I need to sell him even further, so I'm going to say he's a man of valor and a man of war." Perhaps he knew of, because we read later in chapter 17, where he kills the lion and the bear, and perhaps he is referring to those instances.
I have two thoughts. One, the man who was making this recommendation did not have the preconception or bias of having grown up with him, that even though he's 20-ish, he's still the younger brother. Yeah. And if he's seen him play the harp, then he's probably seen the physique that David was alleged to have had. So he's probably assuming.
As a handsome man.
Maybe David had a harp in one hand and a spear in the other. Who knows?
Well, he did use a slingshot, not a spear, against Goliath. And that was likely his weapon of choice. He wasn't like Samson. He didn't use his bare hands to kill the lion. Unlikely, anyway. He likely used a sling, just like he did with Goliath. So perhaps he did hear about the killing of the lion, the killing of the bear, to protect his father's sheep. That is likely, or that is possible, I should say. But that is one of the things, I read that and it's like, now wait a second, if he's a man of war, maybe this thing with David and Goliath already occurred. Well, no, because later it says in chapter 17, verse 14 and 15, David was the youngest and the three oldest followed Saul. The three oldest sons of Jesse were in Saul's army. Verse 15, but David occasionally went and returned to Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So this indicates that he was still a musician for Saul during this time. And I guesstimate that's about 5 years between his calling. I say he's about 15 in chapter 16, and he's about 20 in chapter 17. We have this image, at least I have this image, I can't speak for everybody, that David was a teenager. You know, we see this in all the illustrations and all the stories, that he was a young man, certainly, but we have this idea that he was a teenager, perhaps a young teenager, when he slays Goliath, when he kills Goliath. Well, I posit that he was about 20. And the reason I do that is because right after he kills Goliath in chapter 18, we see that Saul puts him in charge of his armies. Now, even if you've done something great, like slaying Goliath, and even if everybody knows that, I have a hard time believing that someone who's so young would be listened to by all the armies of Saul. So maybe that's my own hang-up. Maybe that's true. I don't know. So I have him at about 20. Still a very young man. Still someone who'd be like, man, you're only 20. You think you can kill Goliath? You know what you're talking about? The idea is he's the baby, right? And very often in families, the baby of the family is never really taken all that seriously. You have a comment? Go ahead.
It just takes me back to the time that Christ was in the temple, and he's just a boy.
Yeah.
But they listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just something out there.
And you're right. I could be having my own prejudice and bias saying that he couldn't have been a teenager at this time. I'm just saying he's got to look the part, at least in my view, as someone who is able to command all these men, and he becomes a captain in his army. Not the whole army. Abner is still the general in charge of the army, but David is placed in some position of authority at this point. And right after, in chapter 18, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. He'd only killed Goliath by this point. So is this a prophetic statement? Or is this maybe he did something in between those two events that had the women singing this song? The women in Jerusalem. Or the women, it wasn't in Jerusalem, was it? It was in Gibeon, I think. When he returned home. All right. Another confusing thing that we see is at the end of chapter 17. At the end of chapter 17. I estimate that David was the musician and armor bearer of Saul for about 5 years, give or take. I mean, it could be a few years, you know, round about, at most 5 years, I think would be a good indication for that. At most 5 years, but it could be as little as a year, who knows. And then we see here in chapter 17 that, you know, that he really doesn't know David. And so he says, when Saul saw, in chapter 17, verse 55, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, king, O king, I do not know. So the king said, inquire whose son this young man is. Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to the man, said to him, whose son are you, young man? So David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Well, he already knows who David is, so why is he going to all this trouble to figure out who he is? Any guesses?
Probably ain't seen him.
Well, I think he had to have seen him if he were his musician and armor bearer, as we see at the end of chapter 16.
Wanting to lead people in battle, I think.
He's wearing a helmet, bronze helmet, opposed to a coated mail. Right?
David? Oh, no. He wore that for a minute, and then he took all that armor off because, yeah, he wasn't, it was too heavy for him, it wasn't fitted for him, it wasn't, no, he took all that armor off.
Is it possible Saul wanted clarification, maybe he wanted to reward his father for some reason?
Possibly. My thought, and I think this is the general consensus of people who've thought about this for a while, is, I think it is anyway, that he was unfamiliar with this side of David. That he's like, who is this guy? I had no idea he was capable of this. Are we sure this is the same person? I need to find out who this is. I mean, he's just my musician and armor bearer, and he goes out and he does this? Something the whole armies of God at this point were unable or unwilling to do? Who is this kid? I've got to find out. And so he goes out and he finds out and he says, "Man, I am just David, the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." And so we see that he was humble in this case, saying that, you know, I'm just a humble servant. I present this to you, this head of the Philistine. This is what I have done, but who was behind David this whole time? It was God. God. Last week we talked about in chapter 18, Jonathan and David and the relationship between these two people. And we see in chapter 18 that at this point, Jonathan's soul was knit to David's. They had become best friends by this point. They make vows later on, not like marriage vows or anything, because some people like to think, oh, there's something going on between those two. And I'm like, no, they were just best friends. And we see, and I guess again, at the where there's a not a guess necessarily, but the indication of the age difference between these two, between Jonathan and David. Again, we often think of them as around the same age, but I have here that there's about a 28-year difference between them. And yet they are the best of friends. And again, I like to think that perhaps Jonathan saw David do this at his young age and think, man, he is a man of faith. I've got to be friends with him. Because Jonathan, several years previously, in 1 Samuel 13 and 14, had gone up against the Philistines at his young age and gone up against them by himself, defeated a whole garrison by himself along with his armor bearer. And so that was a fantastic situation for Jonathan, and we don't give him enough credit, I think, in that regard. So Jonathan does that, and David defeats Goliath. And so they're like, man, he has similar faith to me. I need to be friends with him. And so that's the start of their great friendship that we see. All right. Chapter 18. We see that Saul makes David the captain over 1,000. And it says at some point, where is that? In verse 11, 10 and 11, that Saul was very upset with David. Not necessarily with David, but with the honor that is bestowed upon David by the people, because he had killed the Philistine. And he's very upset that troubled spirit has come upon him again. And he recognizes that his time is up, that his family will not continue on, and he's upset about this. And so he thinks that maybe David is the one that will replace him. And so at least that's my speculation on that part. That's not what Scripture says, I don't think. But I think that he might suspect that David is the one to, especially in verse 8, it says, "Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?' So Saul eyed David from that day forward." And so I suspect that he thinks that David is the one to replace him. And so he's not too happy about that. And so later on, when David is playing in music, verse 11, "And Saul cast the spear for he said, 'I will pin David to the wall.' But David escaped his presence twice." A little bit later on, we see that this something similar occurs. He throws a spear at David and misses, obviously. I think that when he says twice, he's not saying it happened twice in chapter 18, but it happened once here in 18 and once at the other instance that we'll get to. So I don't think it happened three times. I think it only happened twice. And the reason for thinking that is, in this particular case, he is, you know, why would David allow himself to be a target twice so quickly?
He knew God was with him.
He knew God was with him. But anyway, that's just my guess on that as well. There's a lot of guesswork in this section, so I apologize for that. But, you know, we're trying to make sense of this timeline. And so trying to put things in their particular order and making things fit in some way. And so there has to be a little bit of guesswork involved in some of these things. And I'm trying to be very clear where there is guesswork. So you might think, oh, maybe David was a little younger at certain points. Well, maybe. And so that's fine. That's fine. I have no complaints against that. Although he was 30 when he becomes king. And so Saul's reign, 10 years into his reign, when David is born. And that part, I will not budge on. All right, next we're going to talk about David's mighty men with a little bit of time we have left. And they're recorded all the way back into 2 Samuel 23. So this is one of the fun things about this particular study. You see all these mighty men that are talked about that are listed here in 2 Samuel 23. And they're also listed in 1 Chronicles 11. And in 1 Chronicles 11, David has just become king over all Israel. And it says a little bit later on, now these were his mighty men. And so that's where Chronicles comes at it from. 2 Samuel, this is toward the end of David's reign. At the first part of 2 Samuel 23, he says, these are the last words of David. And then he goes into, here are David's mighty men. And then chapter 24 talks about the census that was made, against what God wanted. So that's kind of an addition as well. But here we see all these mighty men. And we see some clues here that many of these things take place perhaps not at the end of David's reign, but throughout David's, not only his reign, but his tenure as a military commander. And so I place a lot of those things at around this time, after he is made the captain of 1,000. And so many of those are his mighty men, and all of the great deeds that they do, I place at this point. Because then you have the saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has 10,000s, becomes immediately a reality. Whereas it could have been prophetic, talked about at that point at the end of, after David kills Goliath, it becomes an immediate reality right afterwards. And he kills so many men through his mighty men. All right, so I have again on the timeline, it is during this time that David marries Saul's daughter, Michal. All right, so he marries Saul's daughter, Michal. And do you remember the dowry that Saul demanded of David? Yeah. 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And he thought, this is really clever, Saul thinks. This is really clever. Here's what I'm going to do. I am going to put him in danger, and I am going to say he is going to go out and fight against the Philistines, do this impossible task, and he will be killed as a result. And I won't have to worry about him after that. He doesn't kill 100 Philistines. He kills 200. Lays them at Saul's feet, and he has no choice but to give him his daughter. So that happens at around this time. Could have been aided by his mighty men at this time. So that's why I place his mighty men here. There is also an instance talked about in chapter 11, I think, of 1 Chronicles, and also in 2 Samuel 23, where he gets water. And it actually has this time statement of when that occurs. And we'll talk about that maybe next week. Because after this, I also have some footnotes as to some of the goings-on of David's mighty men. And so we'll look at that perhaps next week. But after this, David flees because Saul is out to get him. For real this time. Not just throwing spears at him, but wants to go out and kill him. And he lies in wait for him when he is in his bed with Michal. So, that is the end of this particular class, I think. Next week, we'll talk about David's flight. David is on the run. He flees from Saul. All right. Very good.